Yeah, thank you very much. It's great pleasure to speak here. Hopefully this is working. But yeah, for the Zoom. Okay. Right. Okay. So I'll talk about a certain polytope, which we call lambda polytopes, and which are essentially introduced quite recently in a joint work with Michael Zurel and Robert Rosandorf. So this polytope is very much related to the stabilizer formalism. So there is a duality relationship between the two. And using this polytope, you can construct a classical simulation algorithm essentially for any quantum computation. And today, I'll be focusing on the mathematical properties of this polytope, which is essentially the main obstacle for understanding the efficiency of the algorithm for certain cases, when it is efficient, when it's not. This is the outline. First, I'll provide some motivation and background. Mainly, I'll start the story from the qubits, where the local dimension is odd, and then turn into qubits. There are many difficulties, and then how we arrived at this lambda polytopes. Then I'll give the definition of lambda polytopes. There is an associated hidden variable model that you can construct, and then there is a resulting classical simulation algorithm. The classical simulation algorithm is based on the it's a distribution, probability distribution on the vertices of the polytope. So you need, at the end of the day, a description of the vertices if you want to analyze the algorithm. But so far, we only know certain classes of vertices, which are called these closed non-contextual vertices. To be able to study the polytope more generally, you need some general methods. One of the methods we have is these maps between lambda polytopes. So if you have a lambda polytope defined for some number of qubits, so you can map it into another lambda polytope with higher number of qubits. And then that sends vertices to vertices. This gives you a way to study lambda polytopes for high number of qubits. Essentially, this also allows you to restrict to a very small number of qubits. Essentially, number two qubits is quite at the boundary, so we can understand it numerically, the polytope, but we cannot understand the vertices in a mathematically coincide nice way. So that's kind of the outline. Most of the work is joint with Michael and Robert, and the last part is joint with my postdocs, Hoyu Chang and Sal Manipek. So that's the outline. So the motivation comes from finding the essential quantum resources behind quantum computational speedup. And this is going to be investigated in a collaborative project between Canada and Europe. And here we have there are like four Canadian institutions, and the rest is in Europe. From Waterloo, there's John Yart involved. And this is the starting point. And we are looking approaching this problem from the simulation algorithm based on lambda polytopes. The stabilizer theory essentially is quite tractable. So that's the Gottesman-Kleene theorem that says stabilizer subtheory is efficiently classically simulatable. But you can upgrade it to universality using the QCM scheme. That's the quantum computation with magic states due to Bravi and Kitaev. So what you do is essentially take the stabilizer subtheory, which consists of stabilizer states, Clifford unitaries, and Pauli measurements, and then include another quantum state, which is typically a non-stabilizer state. So one example would be this T gate applied to the plus one eigenstate of the X Pauli operator, which gives you that single qubit state. So that's essentially how we imagine a quantum computation. So you initiate your system with a quantum state, if your algorithm uses n magic states, you would start from n-fold tensor of these t states. And then you would apply the Clifford unitaries and Pauli measurements in sequence to get your to have your computation. So one thing I would like to note is that in our algorithm, we actually don't use Clifford unitaries. You can always commit these Clifford unitaries past the measurements, and you can ignore them, essentially. So you can think of the QCM scheme as follows. You start from a state, a quantum state, and then you apply a sequence. You apply a sequence of Pauli measurements, which are usually adaptive for your computation. Given this, we will. I mean, the classical simulation algorithm is going to be try to simulating that. Okay. So the story starts in the odd local dimensions, which behaves nicer than qubits, which is because of essentially the non-presence of state-independent contextuality. Essentially, Merman square doesn't give you a contextuality proof in the odd case. So so the first result here is due to Veitch et al., which says that quantum computation with magic states can have quantum speed up only if the Wigner function is negative. So Wigner function here is a discrete Wigner function, which describes your system using as a quasi-probability distribution on a phase space. And the phase space here is a finite set. If your Wigner function turns out to be a probability distribution, so it doesn't have any negativity, then you can simulate your computation. So that's the that's what happens in the odd local dimensional case. So you can so there's also how in this case, in the odd local dimensional case, Wigner negativity is very much related to quantum contextuality, and you can actually show that quantum contextuality is a necessary resource in this case. So this is a result due to Howard et al. So the nice thing in the odd local dimensional case is that contextuality with respect to all Pauli measurements is equivalent to Wigner negativity. So there's this nice equivalence there, which breaks down completely in the case of qubits.
Holds for any local dimension or odd, the first
one? Everything here is odd local dimension.
Each of these only holds for odd local dimensions.
Sorry?
Each of these statements only holds for odd local dimensions.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So everything, yeah, each of them here is for odd local dimensions. So in this slide, I'm restricting to odd local dimensions. So qubits where the D local dimension is odd. So to be able to say something why in the qubit case things break down, I want to talk about the Wigner function without giving full details. So a Wigner function is a quasi-probability distribution on the phase space. And the phase space is Z mod D to power 2n here that you can see. So you can recognize this as the labels for the Pauli operators up to a scalar. So this is your phase space. And then if you have a quantum state, you can represent it as a quasi-probability distribution on this phase space. There are two nice properties which allows you to make the Veitch et al.'s algorithm tick. One of them is Clifford covariance, and the other one is positivity preservation under Pauli measurements. So the first one says that if you look at the Wigner function after you conjugate your quantum state with unitary, that Wigner function is related to the original one by an affine symplectic transformation on the phase space. So here, SU is a symplectic transformation, and this is a shift by the phase space element. So this is a symplectic transformation. And the second one here is the positivity preservation, which is very important because, as I said, essentially you can ignore the Clifford unitaries. The measurement part is more crucial. So if you start with something positive, if your Wigner function is positive at each phase point, then after you do the measurement, so essentially conjugating with the projector, you stay positive. So this is very important because So you present your quantum state as a probability distribution, and then the measurement takes you to another probability distribution. So that is how the simulation works in this case.
Can you just say what the definition of
Sorry, that's why I tried to warn. So I'm not going to be giving the definitions for the Wigner functions at this point.
Symplectic transformation, just
I see. Yeah, so I will get back to the definition of the Clifford unitary. Unitaries and the Pauli group, so I will go over them. The reason I had to do this technical thing, inserting them, just to mention the Clifford covariance and positivity preservation, which essentially breaks in the qubit case. So that's kind of takes us to why the algorithm actually fails for the qubit case. And I will give more details on each of these things, but I won't be defining Wigner functions because the distributions that I will talk about on lambda polytopes, they are related, but they don't need the description for Wigner functions. So this is this particular distribution is used in the odd local dimensions for simulation. Okay, so if your distribution is positive, then you can efficiently classically simulate. Now, so going back to the qubits here from, so now I want to say some things about qubits. Okay, so the two nice properties, the covariance, Clifford covariance fails. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that the positivity preservation under Pauli measurements fails. So these are known. And so the first one is shown by Zhu, and the second one is the phase space paper joined with Robert and many other people here. That paper is a qubit counterpart of Weichertal's result. So these two fails. And in a very recent paper, we have came up with an explanation that's more cohomological. So if you heard of these, this topological approach to quantum contextuality, there is some similar structures appearing which detects these failure as a cohomology class. So that's just a note on that. So another indication that the phase space in the qubit case is too small, in fact, is the result due to Karanje, Wolman, and Bartlett, which says that if you have contextuality, which always exists because of Merman square in the qubit case, you need a quadratic size phase space. So here the phase space is linear, so it's not going to be enough for qubits. So you essentially this indicates that you need something larger. Okay, so now I want to give some basics. So the Pauli groups here, I will only talk about the qubit case, so I'm not introducing them more generally. So here, X and Z are Pauli matrices, 2 by 2 Pauli matrices, and the phase space is quite important here. That's the labels for the Paulis up to scalars. So it has two parts, Z mod 2 to the power n, so it's n bits, another n bits. So this is called the Z part and the X part. Given these two n bits, you can construct the Pauli operators as follows. So you raise the Z operators to that power, they're either 0 or 1 here, and you take the tensor powers. So this I here indicates that it's acting on the ith qubit, and then you have a corresponding X part, and you combine them. There's a phase in front. You can have different choices for the phase, which doesn't affect the math too much at the end of the day, but this is one fixed choice. Here. So this is the dot product of the two bits. And the main player here is a group theoretic object, I mean, which is precisely a group, the Pauli group, which is defined as plus minus TAs and plus minus ITA. So these are the elements of the group. This is a subgroup of the unitary group acting on n-qubit Hilbert space. The Clifford group is defined as a normalizer of this Pauli group inside the unitary. So this is another finite group, and its structure is as follows. So that's where the symplectic group appears. So if you take the Clifford group, a subgroup of the unitary, kill the central elements in this group, you will get this finite group, which looks like this. So there are two parts. The first part here, essentially the Pauli operator. So you can think of Pauli operators inside the Clifford group. You can think of that part. This is Z mod 2 to the power T 2n. If you kill that subgroup inside the Clifford group, you get another group, which is the symplectic group. In the first slide, I was talking about symplectic transformations. This is essentially that part. So this structure is very important in whole stabilizer theory, the Clifford structure of the Clifford group. So here in this talk, I will be focusing on the structure of the Pauli group rather than the Clifford group. So the Pauli group, what you want to know, first of all, you want to know when two operators commute. And these given two operators, they commute. I mean, you can actually, the first description here for TA, what you need, in fact, like formal properties of TA, such as when they commute, right? So you can derive from the definition that they commute whenever this formula here, which turns out to be a symplectic form, vanishes. Okay, so you get a zero here, so that you will get an identity. But they anti-commute when this thing is equal to one. So here the formula means that you get this bits, n bits here for each part, and then you take the dot product of these n bits, and then at the end of the day you get a zero or one. So this symplectic form turns this phase space into a symplectic vector space, and you can choose a canonical basis here where these small letters z and x's, they correspond to the capital z and x, which are the Pauli operators acting on each qubit. Now, to be able to define stabilizer states, you need the abelian subgroups of Pn. Here, you can think about abelian subgroups as subspaces of the phase space, which satisfies the property that for any pair of elements, the symplectic form vanishes. So such subspaces are called isotropic. So abelian subgroups of the Pauli group are the same as, you can think of them as the isotropic subspaces in the phase space. Now, you would like to track the products of Pauli operators. Essentially, if you're given two Pauli operators, the product is going to differ from the sum of the labels, right? The operator that corresponds to the sum of the labels by plus or minus one. And this phase factor here is governed by that function beta. So we are only considering here commuting Paulis. So this function beta can be more formally studied. So this is the theory of group extensions essentially. So there's lots of algebra going on here, group theory going on here. So I was referring to that cohomology stuff. So that essentially comes from that beta, the cohomological stuff that I was talking about. But in this talk, I won't be mentioning that. So how do you define a stabilizer state? So they are defined as the states that are stabilized by a maximal elements in a maximal abelian subgroup of the Pauli group. I think there is a more explicit way here is that if you take these computational basis element in the n qubits, you can generate all the stabilizer states by acting by the Clifford unitaries. That's another way of thinking about them. If you look at the corresponding projector, they have this nice form. You have the Pauli operators here with plus minus one coefficients. I need this explicit description because that description, a similar description here, is going to appear in the vertices of the polytope. So that's why I have it here. And this S function is special. So this is called the value assignment to each element of the isotropic subspace. And by a value assignment, we mean that this formula holds. So the values at the sum of the values is equal to the value associated with the sum of the labels, but you need to twist by that beta value. So this is zero or one. If you're familiar with character theory, this is like twisted character theory restricted to commuting pairs of elements. These are called value assignments. So I'll denote these stabilizer states, pure stabilizer states, by Sn. So they will be needed in the definition of the lambda polytope. Any questions? Okay. So this is the lambda polytope. The definition here is as follows. So the lambda polytope for n qubits consists of Hermitian operators of trace one. And when you take the product with a stabilizer projector, the trace is non-negative for all stabilizer, pure stabilizer states. So I was talking about this duality. So that condition, the non-negativity here is precisely the duality condition. So you have the stabilizer states. Just think of it as a polytope where the vertices are stabilizer states. The dual of that polytope is precisely lambda. So maybe I can say more on the dual in the picture. So this is the picture for, so the cube here is the picture for a single qubit. Now the sphere is the Bloch sphere. This is the states, quantum states for a single qubit. The octahedron inside is the stabilizer states, right? The vertices are the stabilizer states, and then you take all the convex mixtures. The duality says that the vertices are replaced by facets. So a vertex here is replaced by this facet here. So that's the duality relation. So if you take the dual of this stabilizer polytope for single qubits, you get this cube. And the vertices are, there are 8 vertices for the lambda. This is very simple. But things get dramatically complicated if you go to 2 qubits, as I will give you more insight in the couple of minutes. So this notation will carry over. So the vertices of the lambda polytope is going to be denoted by alphas here. So this is the index, and A alpha is the corresponding operator in the Hermitian space of Hermitian operators. So Vn is going to be the new phase space, in fact.
What's the reason for the trace condition?
So the trace condition is that we want them to behave like quantum states. There's a normalization.
So I would have thought you want them to behave more like effects because the stabilizers are the states. These are going to be the states and the states.
These are the states, yes.
Stabilizers are going
to
be
effects, yeah. Exactly. So if I were to replace, if I instead of taking pure stabilizers, if I take all the projectors here, then lambda n would coincide with the density operators. Yes. So it's that kind of relation we have. These are states. Okay. So this picture is a good picture for a single qubit because for a higher number of qubits, it's impossible to draw the picture. So this comes out of the definition. So first of all, every n qubit quantum state, rho, so this is a density operator, can be represented as a probability function on the set of vertices. That essentially says that the lambda polytope contains density operators, n qubit density operators. So that means you can express rho as a probabilistic mixture of the vertices. So that's what it is. So by the way, I should say the number of vertices is finite for lambda. This is quite nice property. For any Pauli operator, TA, you can write it as a difference of two projectors, spectral decomposition, and the vertex of lambda, the conjugate, which is essentially for simulating the measurements. So the conjugate here is, if it is non-zero, it will be contained in the polytope after normalization. That's a very crucial property. So therefore, you can obtain these probabilities. So these are the transition probabilities corresponding to Pauli measurements. So this is a distribution on the set of vertices times the outcomes, 0 or 1. Now, so these distributions are coming from these convex decompositions since they fall inside the polytope. And you can combine these Q functions into a transition probability like this. It's like a conditional probability. And then using the initial distribution that comes from the quantum state, so this distribution P rho, you can reproduce the Born rule in a classical fashion. So the Born rule is the projector times the quantum state traced. So you can do it for any quantum state. So what is crucial here is that both the quantum state, the initial quantum state, and the measurements, they're all represented as probability distributions. There's no negativity anywhere. in contrast to Wiechertal's result. So you can turn this theorem into a classical simulation algorithm given a quantum state together with a sequence of Pauli operators. So this is your computation in the QCM scheme. So first you represent your quantum state using the probability distribution on the set of vertices, and then you sample from that distribution to get the initial vertex, which is alpha zero. And then for each measurement in your sequence, you need to update your vertex using the these probabilities, Q probabilities. So that will tell us what the new vertex is and what the outcome associated to the measurement is. So you will output this outcome and then update your vertex to beta, and so on. So you do it at each step. So that's the so this algorithm is precisely, I mean, this is very similar to, if you do it with Wigner functions, then it is essentially the Wiechertal's simulation algorithm. So that's more details on that here, how the algorithm works. So now, if you do it for single qubits, so you have this cube, and if you start from a vertex, say your initial distribution gave one of these vertices, and then you apply a measurement. What you can apply is x, y, or z. I think this picture is for z measurement. Say you're at this point, at this vertex, with 1/2 probability you will stay at this vertex, or you will move to this vertex here, right? So it's like you will flip a coin, you will stay here or move to the other vertex. So these transitions are precisely formulated. So you know where to go, but we only know these transitions for the CNC, these special type of vertices, which I will talk about. In the case of a single qubit, all the vertices are CNC type, so well understood, and it's quite simple, as you can see, it's just a cube. But for larger number of qubits, we need to define what these CNC vertices are. So CNC stands for closed and non-contextual, so let's define this. So first of all, some relaxation happens at the level of the sets here. Instead of subspaces, you work with subsets. So they are more general than, for example, isotropic subspaces. So a subset is closed if you have two elements that commute. In other words, the symplectic form vanishes, then the sum is supposed to be inside the set. So this is closeness. Non-contextual means that it admits a value assignment. So the value assignment, I mentioned that in the case of isotropic subspace, is quite similar. So if you have two elements that commute in the set, then this function satisfies this formula, the same formula that I mentioned. So you have the sum of the outcomes is related to the outcome assigned to the sum inside the set, but you need to twist by beta. And the omega sets we are interested in are CNC sets, meaning that both closed and non-contextual. So they satisfy these two properties. So you can define an associated operator, which essentially looks like these stabilizer projectors, but they are more general because you have a set here, a larger set than an isotropic space. So the coefficients are, again, plus minus one, determined by the value assignments. So these are vertices of lambda polytopes that we call CNC vertices. OK. Yeah, so the first result is that, you have to choose maximal CNC sets. Sorry, I haven't said that. So these sets are supposed to be maximal possible CNCs. These turn out to be vertices of lambda n. And now we can think about the subset of vertices which are CNC vertices inside the larger full phase space. OK, so as I said, for these CNC vertices, the update rule is known. Which was, just remember the picture on the cube with these red arrows. If you do your measurement, if your measurement is labeled inside the set, then you have this uniform either zero or this uniform mixture, which is the case that happened in the cube, uniform mixture. If your measurement label is outside the set, then you get this new vertex with an updated value assignment. So the formula for the updated value assignment is not given here. For us, it's not going to be important, but the main thing here is that it's just two lines of update rules. It's quite simple. So given these CNC vertices, we can define this CNC subpolytope as a convex hull. These are fully understood, as you can see, description of the vertices plus the update rules. And the goal is to do it for all the vertices, or as much as you can. Probably it's quite a hard task to do it for all of them. Okay, so we can define the region of efficient classical simulation inside lambda. If rho can be represented by a probability distribution on the CNC part, the CNC vertices, then the classical simulation is going to be efficient, quite a similar reasoning as the Bech et al.'s result. So just imagine that this huge lambda polytope and you have this smaller CNC polytope, which contains some of the states. It's not going to contain all of the states. So you will see some negativity appearing here if you move outside the CNCs. But everything is always positive with respect to the full lambda. Okay, so now in the next part of my talk, I will show you how to possibly extend the CNC vertices to other kinds of vertices and how things get complicated and some general methods that works for these lambda polytopes. So you can extend it to a larger subpolytope as follows, essentially. So first of all, there's this nice tool which allows you to map the lambda m for m less than or equal to n to a larger, the other lambda n for a higher number of qubits. So I will talk about this map. It's a quite natural map in the sense of quantum computing. I will mention what this map is. The nice property is going to be vertices are sent to vertices. So that means if you understand a small a lambda polytope for a small number of qubits, then if you describe a vertex, you can apply the phi map to get a class of vertices for each n. So this is how you can use that theorem. And together with the theorem, there's a reduction of the simulation algorithm. So if you look at the vertices that are generated by this phi map, you can always reduce your simulation to a smaller number of qubits. Again, the smallest thing we can choose here is 2, essentially, because if you choose 1, they're already CNC, you will generate more CNCs, so that's nothing new. But there are interesting classes in lambda 2, so this polytope is very interesting.
Can you have CNC vertices mapped to non-CNC vertices? Is that the idea?
Okay, so that's the third part of the theorem. Yeah, that's a good question because, yeah, I mean, you need to keep CNCs and CNCs, yeah. Okay, so let me go over the more precise statement. So if you have an n-qubit Clifford unitary U and then n minus m-qubit stabilizer state, so m is less than n here. The phi map is defined quite naturally, so you would tensor with a stabilizer state and then conjugate with the Clifford unitary. So that's quite a natural map. So it turns out that this map is injective on the polytopes. And also, it takes a vertex to the vertex, as I said. But then the third property is also important, which says that in the smaller polytope, a vertex is CNC if and only if in the larger polytope, this image phi of the vertex is also CNC. So if you start from a CNC, apply phi, you stay CNC. If you start from non-CNC, apply phi, you stay non-CNC. So you ensure yourself that you generate a new class. That's why it's important here to have the third part. So the reduction algorithm more formally says the following. If we consider vertices in small number of qubits and apply all possible combinations, any stabilizer state and any Clifford here, I just look at all combinations, then I will generate a subset of vertices in the full vertex set. So let's call it Vn tilde. The classical simulation algorithm with state space Vn tilde can be efficiently reduced to a classical simulation on the state space corresponding to m qubits. So you can just push it back to small number of qubits. That's the more formal statement. Okay, so how the 2-qubit polytope looks like, just to give you some idea. Okay, so the first single qubit lambda, it has 8 vertices. So you can choose plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus here. There are 8 choices, which gives you the 8 vertices in the cube. So that's how the vertices look like. All of them are of this form. If you go to 2 qubits, you can understand the polytope using like some software like Polymake. It will generate the vertices. So you have 22,320 vertices. So a nice, yeah, it's too much. Yeah, from 8 to 22,320 is too much. But there's a nice property. If you use symmetry, is the Clifford group action. The orbit, meaning that if you start from a vertex, you can apply a Clifford unitary. You are guaranteed to stay a vertex. And there are vertices that you can reach by applying this Clifford unitaries. This 22,320 breaks into 8 classes, 8 orbits. Yes. So just to give you a comparison, this reduction to 8 is reasonable because the Clifford group has order 11,520. It's kind of comparable to this. So you reduce it to 8. I mean, a nice general theorem would be a similar reduction for n qubits. Would be very interesting to have. Among these 2 orbits inside 8, 2 of them are of CNC type. So let me give you these representatives. So there's type 1, type 2. So the Pauli coordinates, so these are the expectations, right, with respect to these Pauli operators, the values here either 0 or plus minus 1, similarly here. But using the unitary Clifford unitaries, you can't go from this one to that one. They are in distinct orbits. So the other thing is that we know how the CNC sets are described. So the structure of the CNC sets are well understood. So for example, the first type, if you look at the values where non-zero values, so you see ix, iz, xx, yx, and zx here. This is a 5 pairwise anti-commuting Paulis. So the CNC, maximal CNCs of type 1 are given by those pairwise anti-commuting unitary Paulis. So the structure for type 2 is different. So you can look at this, it's like a union of 3 isotropics, maximal isotropics at a single one-dimensional isotropic and so on. So you can describe. So there's a nice structural results about these CNC subsets. Okay, so what's complicated is the abelian subgroups of the Paulis, or you can think of it as the subspace of isotropic subspaces. So this is for 2 qubits. The picture represents these single Pauli operators, right? These are the large blue parts, and there are these abelian subgroups of size which contain these. Like for example, this red dot contains this 1. 2, 3. So these are pairwise commuting. So this is like the structure of the abelian subgroups or the isotropic subspaces. So there are identifications appearing on the outer boundary. So this is like a complicated complicated picture. So it's kind of hard to work with it. So that's kind of the complication is coming from there. So it's for different reasons, I spend a lot of time in this structure, starting from my PhD thesis for different kinds of problems. But this is a quite a interesting rich structure. If you know about finite geometries, this picture is also related to these finite geometries that arises in mathematics. So the new type of vertex that I want to describe, that's not a CNC type inside lambda 2, is as follows. Just to give you a taste of how things get slightly different than the CNC, so you can appreciate the complication of the vertices. So if you take this vertex, type 3, so this is not CNC because you will start seeing values outside of plus minus 1 and 0. So you see this plus minus 1 over 2s. So that you can give a description of this vertex in a closed form. So it has these 3 parts. So this is a stabilizer projector, And there are two CNC-like operators, but they are not CNC. They're only non-contextual, but not closed. So you need some relaxation on the notions. Also, this weird combination of the operators appears. But the good thing is that you can derive. Okay, so maybe I should go a bit more on the structure of these things. So you can describe the structure of these sets, the omega sets that appear in this type 3 vertex, by working on this structure of these isotropic subspaces. So I won't go into the details of this. But the good thing is, since you have three parts which are almost like CNC, you can use the update rules. So for example, this vertex, this particular vertex, can be represented with these two parameters here. So you have a maximal isotropic given by these generators, and then you have this omega set. And there are also three value assignments. So the structure, as you see, gets a bit complicated. So it's kind of like the next level from CNCs. As I said, you can use the update rule for the CNCs, and you have three parts. So the first one is like a CNC type update rule. The second part is also like a CNC type update rule, but you need to take the closure of these omega sets. Anyway, so I mean, if you just try to do this, the update rules from two lines, they get quite complicated. So you have three cases and two subcases for each of them. So you can write down what happens. For these, that works, but they are more complicated than CNCs. So there needs to be a better framework where you can actually track these in a more systematic way. So that's kind of a missing thing. Okay, so this new vertex, which is not CNC in two qubits, actually can be used to extend the region of efficient simulation. That's illustrating what we want to do in the program. So the extended set of vertices, so this new type of vertices here, these type 3, I can apply the phi map for any combination of these, the stabilizer and the Clifford unitaries, to get this set, append it to the CNCs, right? Now, the polytope defined for this W set with vertices given by this W set is going to be anything inside that polytope is going to be classically, the simulation is going to be efficient. The classical simulation is going to be efficient. So that's kind of the program. So we want to extend it to a larger class of vertices as we understand the vertices. So there are two things to understand: description of the vertex and the update rule. You need both. Okay. So in the last part of my talk, okay, maybe I should finish quickly in 6 minutes. Okay, so I just want to talk about the lambda 2 in particular. So it's not fully understood how this polytope can be studied and how that polytope relates to other kinds of polytopes that appear in quantum foundations. Like, essentially, I'm talking about non-signaling polytopes for Bell scenarios, for example. And there's another polytope which we call Mermin polytope. So I won't be giving full details of definitions, and I'm planning to do some of the definitions in my next talk tomorrow at IQC. So hopefully this is going to bridge from this talk to the other one. Okay, so type 2 vertex, we talked about it. This type 3, I mean, there are two vertices here, just samples. So the coordinates here are expectation coordinates, as I said, right? So these are expectations with respect to Pauli's. You can go to another coordinates, the probability coordinates, right? So you can go to probability coordinates where you consider the maximal isotropic subspaces, as you see. So these are maximally commuting abelian groups, right? So you have xi, ix, the product of that, and so on. So the blue part is the local, which we call the local, we refer to it as the local subspaces, and these are our local operators, and these are the non-local operators here. It's better to call them like contexts from the foundation's perspective. So these are contexts, and we can look at the 1-1 outcome minus 1-1, 1-1 minus 1 outcome, and I can look at these probabilities. So every column is a probability, right? So this is a probability table. At the end of the day. So I can represent the vertices as probability tables. And probability tables are essentially, they appear in the non-signaling distributions, right? So non-signaling distributions are compatible probability tables. So what I want to do, so the blue and red here, we can decompose this table into two parts, the local part and the non-local part, and then that will allow us to study the lambda 2. So let me describe the local part first. So this gives us a Bell scenario. So if you project down to the local context, so those are of the form, like these ones, the blue part, then this gives us a map from the lambda polytope to the non-signaling polytope for the Bell scenario 2, 3, 2. So that means you have this is a bipartite scenario, three measurements for each, and then binary outcomes. So that so you have an injective map to this non-signaling polytope. The dimensions are the same. These are both 15 dimensions. So the vertices of these polytopes are worked out by Jones and Massanis. So they are well known. What you do here, you think of two parties like Alice and Bob. They are performing these local measurements like X, I, Y, I, Z, I, and the Bob is performing the others. So you can interpret the blue part of the lambda vertices as NS, non-signaling distributions, and then embedded inside there. The reason is that the vertices of these things are well understood, so you might learn from them. And the non-local part is the red part, and you can assemble the red part into a Merman square. That's a solution for the linear system for the linear system for the Merman scenario. So the parity of the linear system is odd in this case. And then you can define distributions on this part, on this linear system, which are essentially going to look like these red parts. So you just look at this part only, the distributions here. You need a non-signaling condition as well to make sense of these distributions. So that's a new polytope MP1, which we call the Merman polytope. Sure.
I know you explained it. I'm sure you did, but I kind of lost track of it. Can you explain what the red part means?
So the red part here, okay, sorry, the definitions are not very precise here. I'm just giving an overview, and then hopefully I will describe the Merman polytope in my next talk more precisely. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 contexts, and these six contexts, they also have intersections. For example, XY intersects with XY here. So it belongs to two contexts, that one and that one. So you're looking at probability tables like these ones so that when you single out a measurement, the marginals at that measurement is supposed to match.
Okay.
This is the Merman polytope, MP1.
Okay.
And the linear constraint is supposed to be satisfied on the outcomes as well. So the linear constraint, so three of these context are assigned to 0, and the other three is assigned to 1 in the linear system. So hopefully I'll do tomorrow a better job on explaining this, but at the end of the day, you get something like a non-signaling polytope with the additional data of the linear system. So it's a smaller polytope. Okay, thanks for the question. Okay, so we have these two parts, blue and the red, NS232 and MP1. Now, you can actually go from NS232 to MP1 if you allow quasi-probability distributions with sign. Not probability distribution, but quasi-probability distributions. So here is a picture. So this is the picture of the big picture I showed you, isotropic subspaces separated into two parts. The local part, you see these are all local operators acting on a single qubit. And then these are all the remaining non-local parts. The gray bits here, so if I look at, for example, here, there should be XX here. This XX appears on the other side over there. This map is defined as follows. So we are on the left-hand side. We have a non-signaling distribution on this thing. We can compute the marginals for these product operators from the whole distribution. So we get to the right-hand side, so these distributions on these blue things, and then we can extend them to each context. So So that's the two steps going on here. At the end of the day, you get a map like this from one polytope to another thing, which allows you, which is quasi-property distributions on Murmur Square. And the whole distribution here, if you look at the whole thing, this is lambda 2. The result says the following. So the lambda 2, we have two maps, one to NS232, the other one to NP1. From NS, you can go to quasi-property distributions, and honest property distributions, they live inside this thing. Lambda 2 can be characterized as polar. So this is purely, this is not operator theoretic, right? This is just property theoretic description of lambda 2. It is precisely the preimage of NP1. In other words, lambda 2 is precisely those non-signaling distributions on the Bell scenario, which maps to property distributions on the Murmur Square. And then this gives you a decomposition of lambda 2 into two parts. You have NS232, NP1, and whose vertices are understood. As I said, the first one is described by Jones and Massanes, and we described this one, NP1, quite recently. So that's the result I was referring to, joint with my postdocs. The thing here that I want to emphasize is the vertices are maximal non-local CNC sets. So if you remove the non-local, these are the vertices of lambda 2, right? The CNC vertices. So these are the non-local versions of them. In other words, if you go from lambda 2 down to NP1, you're only capturing the type 1, type 2 vertices, the CNCs. You're losing the information about the other kinds. So you need to see the interaction of the two to be able to understand the remaining six types. I mean, we also have an understanding of type 3, but not from this perspective. So this perspective is kind of new, more systematic. Okay. So tomorrow, hopefully, I will talk about more topological pictures in the context of polytopes. So this is the picture of NP1. The yellow things are on the vertices are, so first of all, this picture, if you have seen contextuality in the topological framework, so this picture represents the Murmur Square as a torus. And then the yellow parts are CNC sets depicted on the torus. So the edges on the NP1, the Murmur polytope, they also are some sort of CNC sets, but rather the complements of the CNC sets. They are described by loops on the torus. So there are some topological stuff appearing in the context of these Murmur polytropes. So hopefully I will be able to say more on these tomorrow. Okay, so just to finish, sorry, hopefully I'm not going over time. So the goals here, the remaining things are classification of vertices of lambda 1, so that's the big project, update rules under Pauli measurements. Of course, the role of symmetry is you cannot avoid, I mean, you need the Clifford action to be able to understand the vertices and the update rules. So that's very important. So what you can learn, but can you learn anything from the representation theory of Clifford groups, for example, in this context? How does it act on the polytope? Does it really break into smaller pieces that you can analyze at once? So there's also recent work joint with Michael, Robert, and Arne Heimendel from David Gross's group, so which is arbitrary local dimension. So you can define lambda polytopes for any local dimension, not just qubits. If you do that, okay, so maybe I can just clarify the Wigner functions in this context. The maximal CNCs are essentially the operators that are used to define the discrete Wigner function. So that there's a connection there. So you can see the point operators that are used in the Wigner function description as the vertices, some of the vertices of CNC type vertices of the odd local dimensional version of the lambda. So there is a connection there. So Veitch et al.'s polytope sits inside lambda in this case, maybe a better way to put it. And of course, relation to other kinds of polytopes, I mean, we want to prove some sort of Hartness theorem, and it's in complexity theory, it seems like graph theoretic problems, and they give rise to polytopes that are proved to show some separation results. Like, I think one of the famous ones are cut polytopes. And recently I've noticed that there is some work due to Avis et al. Where they actually identify some bell polytopes as some sort of cut polytope. So that's there's like a nice connection. Maybe these kind of there's a better connection between these, because that's kind of the goal, like having these non-singling type distributions, description of lambda versus these graph theoretic polytopes. Maybe there's a better way to bridge them and learn from those. So we need more better graph theoretic, polytope theoretic techniques to be able to understand this thing. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. That's all.
Anything from Zoom? Okay, I have a question. So, what's the relation between this paradigm and the magic state paradigm?
The magic state paradigm, you can think of, the magic state paradigm, you start from a single qubit state and then you take the n-fold tensor, and that will be your initial state. So in this paradigm, we are looking for more arbitrary states, not necessarily in the form of tensor product. Just take an arbitrary density operator and ask whether this gives you any kind of computational power. And that computational power is hidden inside the hardness of the simulation. And the hardness of the simulation is detected by these mathematical obstacles. So you need to understand the vertices, whether the update rules are efficient. So that's kind of the thing. I mean, if you, so that the our goal is to start from arbitrary states rather than tensor product states, but they're quite related. So, I mean, if you start from a T state tensor at N, then you are, of course, expecting to see some hardness in the simulation because it's universal. So yeah.
So this is I'm sort of a bit embarrassed because it's probably a dumb question, but you said those red operators correspond to the Merman polytope.
Yeah. So
my concern is there were six of them, and I would have thought there would be nine because of the.
These are contexts, so there are six contexts.
Something obviously.
Okay, so the red part essentially you can assemble it since I have this blackboard here. So I can take the operators there. So each red operator column is going to correspond to these three rows or three columns, so six. And the operators there, in total, there are nine operators. Okay, so if you look at the Pauli operators, right, so we have xi.
Oh, I see. I'm counting the wrong thing, yeah.
Yeah, I think that
I see, yeah.
Picture might be a bit misleading. So these are the local Paulis, and then six, and then there are nine other ones.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, it's very simple, the answer, and you explained it. It's nice. Thank you.
Okay, and then you try to, look at the distributions on those.
Any other questions?
So the cases when you have efficient simulation algorithms, what is the scaling roughly of the algorithm? Do you know?
The what?
The scaling of the algorithm, like how does it scale with number of qubits or something?
You mean the vertices, the number of vertices? We don't know in general how they scale, but I mean if you go to, it's very, very exponential, but if you go to 3 qubits, for example, we know it's at least of the order of millions, so.
But you mentioned like in some cases you have some efficient algorithms.
Yeah.
What does efficient mean in that setting? Like, is it scaled with like something linear in N or?
I'm not sure. Okay, I'm not sure what your question exactly is, but I think I can refer to the paper.
I guess I wasn't clear what you meant by an efficient simulation algorithm there. In
polynomial time.
Yeah. Polynomial number of qubits is that? Is it for like a fixed number of qubits?
No, it's a fixed number of qubits. So you fix the number of qubits.
I see.
Yeah.
But polynomial.
But there is in that context there is this robustness measure which actually detects whether the algorithm has any hardness, and that depends on the negativity of the Wigner function. Maybe this robustness measure could be more.
So it's like fixed number of qubits, but some number of gates, and it's polynomial in the number of gates or something.
I see your question. now?
Like, what is it efficient in is my question.
I see. Yeah, okay, sorry. I see what you mean. So it's efficient in the number of magic states that you use. Yeah, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, if not, thank you again.
Okay, thank you.